Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Adam. Welcome to the 43rd episode of Robots. In today's show, we focus on the great depths of our ocean and robotic vehicles capable of taking us deeper than we ever imagined. Alberto Colaces Jr. tells us about his institute's highly advanced remotely operated vehicle, or ROV, capable of bringing high-definition video from over 5 kilometers underwater.
Stay tuned after the interview and we'll announce the winner of our Christmas contest and the proud owner of 2 robot kits from Diddle SA. But first, let's hear the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. The year has just begun, but it can already lay claim to some important robotic milestones. First of all, this month marks the 6th anniversary of NASA's Spirit and Opportunity Mars robots. As you may remember from last year's interview with Julie Townsend, the rovers were originally designed to explore Mars for about 3 months, but have now already lasted more than 6 Earth years in the severe Martian environment. Second, following last year's successful navigation of Willow Garage's PR2 robot, the robot has now further extended its skill, set to include learning new motor skills from human demonstration. Third, sales from home robots by Massachusetts-based company iRobot have now surpassed 5 million units since its debut in 2002. Oceanographers from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts have discovered a deep-sea volcano at a depth of more than 1,200 meters in the Pacific Ocean close to Fiji. In what looks like a very dangerous mission for the remotely operated vehicle robot Jason, the volcano can be seen explosively erupted molten lava in a high-definition video recorded during its mission. The video not only marks the deepest underwater volcano eruption ever documented, it was also one of the hottest ever recorded on our planet. A series of robotics novelties were showcased at the annual Consumer Electronics Show, CES, this week in Las Vegas. Among many others, Californian company Evolution Robotics introduced its Mint floor cleaning robot, which can dust and mop hard surface floors. More quietly, a small Silicon Valley-based startup called Nido Robotics has announced the official release of its XV11 robotic vacuum cleaner robot. Both robots look to be designed to bite off a chunk of iRobot's market share, and both use SLAM to map rooms rather than iRobot's random walk strategy. For more information on this episode's news, including videos of Jason's close encounter with an underwater volcano and this year's robot novelties at the CES, visit our forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Alberto Colaces Jr., or Tito to those who know him, is part of the Applied Ocean Physics and Engineering Department at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts in the U.S. Colaces spends much of his time at sea as expedition leader with the Jason Remotely Operated Vehicle, or ROV, which is used throughout the world's oceans to search for old shipwrecks, underwater volcanoes, or deep-sea natural environments that are inaccessible to human-operated vehicles. He tells us about the particular difficulties involved in operating at depths beyond 5,000 meters and the advanced sensors and control systems present on their advanced ROV and base station.
Hi, Tito. Welcome to Robots Podcast.
Hi, Adam. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself to our listeners?
Well, my full name's Alberto Colaces Jr. Everyone calls me Tito. It's kind of a nickname. I've been working at the Woods Hole Oceanographic for about 25 years, the first 15 as a crew member on the research vessels. I started out as a mess attendant and worked my way up to a junior engineer on the Oceanus for the last few years of my career. Once I stopped shipping full-time, I found an interest in ROVs, which had been kind of peaked back in the 80s when the Titanic was discovered. That was my first oceanographic cruise ever, and I was basically the mess attendant washing dishes, and didn't even know this kind of technology existed. But I spent the next 15 years really, working my career towards becoming a member of the Deep Submergence Laboratory, which I finally did in about 2003. And I've been focusing on ROVs and the operation and development of them for about the past 5 or 6 years.
Speaking of ROVs, can you tell us maybe what an ROV is to you?
ROV to me is basically JASON. ROVs come in all different shapes and sizes, but JASON is a remote-operated vehicle. We run it from a ship of opportunity, and it is run via a fiber-optic cable that goes down to the first part of the system, which is Medea. And we have a soft cable going from Medea over to JASON so that Medea takes up the heave of the ship, and JASON is actually free of that.
Tell us a little bit about JASON then. You started talking about it. What is JASON? How big is it? How does it move? What is its purpose?
JASON is a remote-operated vehicle, and it's it was built for oceanographic sampling. It's a 30-horsepower vehicle. It's got 6 thrusters that move it in all directions. It's approximately almost 2 meters tall, 3.5 meters long, and a little over 2 meters wide. It weighs about 4,000 kilograms. Once again, it has 30 horsepower, so about and that is transmitted to the thrusters. We have 6 5-horsepower thrusters, 2 verticals, 2 laterals, and 2 horizontals, and that drives us in all directions. JASON has an amazing closed-loop control system that allows it to basically work in an automatic type of mode while we're using this closed-loop control system. What that does is it uses an ADCP, an acoustic Doppler current profiler, to actually look at the bottom. And what we do is we go into this program we call the closed-loop control system and give it all different commands on directional changes. And basically it can move any way you'd like it to. You can pirouette, you can make it go up, down, sideways, at angles, and such. This closed-loop control system was developed at Johns Hopkins University, and is, I think, part of what sets us apart from the rest of the ROVs out there doing this type of work. It allows us to sit and watch the volcano. The only problem being when the bottom of the ocean actually starts to move, you can't really hold station on something that's moving. JASON also has an amazing, sensor package on board. It's got an Octans ring laser gyro, it's got an altimeter, an RDI ACP, a Tri-Tech sonar, it's got a 3-chip camera for the science group right now, it's got a series of 1-chip cameras for the pilot looking out the front of the vehicle, the back of the vehicle, different views. It's got 2 Craft Predator 2 arms on it right now, the manipulators, and we actually own a Schilling T4 that we can switch out when the science party would prefer that. We have an amazing amount of payload. I think it's almost 400 pounds that we can put on the vehicle to take back to the surface. We also have an elevator system that we can launch from the ship while the vehicle's in the water and recover while the vehicle's in the water. And I use the term elevator loosely. It's basically a float package that we weigh down, sink to the bottom, drive up to with the ROV and change out instruments and then release it either acoustically or with the vehicle itself by pulling a pin on the elevator. We also have a few portable sampling areas called swing arms that will actually come out to the front of the vehicle and you can place any type of scientific instruments on there. We have a big sample basket on the front of the vehicle that goes in and out hydraulically to get us closer to sampling areas but gives us better ergonomics as far as using the arms in the sample basket area. We have an indexable biosampler that we've nicknamed the Slurp Sampler. I think that's most of the instruments that are on JASON. It's capable of going to 6,500 meters. It can stay in the water indefinitely. I think the longest dive we've ever done was on the order of about 140 hours, so about 6 days. The typical user these days does dives between 12 and 24 hours. Just seems a little overwhelming to put the scientists underwater for so long. In the, when we need to be cycling elevators constantly on those long dives, so it's a bit more convenient to actually recover the vehicle and get your hands on things. And that's about it, I think.
Well, that's a great overview. Thank you. Let's talk maybe more on the specific aspects of Jason that you spoke about. For example, the size. Now, of course, if we think about cars, usually a 1,000 kilogram car might have 250 horsepower or something like that. You're talking about a 4,000 kilogram machine that has 30 horsepower. Obviously, we're in water, so we're in a different medium. How do you design maybe ROVs for work underwater? What are important parts? What makes it so heavy? And what kind of thrusters do you have to use to move around, that kind of thing?
Well, the vehicle weighs about 4,000 kilograms in air. Once you put it in water, it's actually positive because of the flotation on it. What we use is syntactic foam. And I believe this is 36-pound foam. So the foam is what weighs the most on the vehicle, I would say. But also, you have to consider you're going to 6,500 meters. So most of your pressure vessels have to be made out of titanium and quite robust. I believe that the main telemetry, high-power and low-power chassis, the big ones on Jason, I believe it's a 7-inch diameter on the tubes, and they're about 6 foot long. The wall thickness is approximately 1 inch. So those weigh a good fair amount, but I believe the foam pack weighs almost 4,000 pounds, but that's what gives us our flotation. The fact that we're only trying to do a half a knot through the water is how we get away with only a half a horsepower. A 1,000-kilogram car with 200 horsepower could probably go 0 to 60 in 6 or 7 seconds. Jason doesn't go to 60. I think its maximum speed is about 1.5 knots flat out. And because Medea lives on top of it and we're actually attached to the ship, we can't go very fast when we're actually trying to drag Medea through the water. So I think in short, most of the weight does come from the syntactic foam, but the whole package the tool sled, the manipulators, everything weighs a significant amount because of the pressures it's going to be subjected to. And I think reiterating the fact that we only need 30 horsepower just because we're not trying to go very fast, I think we were designed to work in up to 2 knots of current.
So maybe how long, just to be curious, how long does it take to go down? You said 6,500 meters, was that?
6,500 meters. Jason's only been to 6,500 meters once.
Okay.
We typically work anywhere from 5,000 to 500 meters. The vehicle descends at approximately anywhere between 30 and 38 meters per minute and can come up about the same speed depending on how much of the payload you've used up. So going to 5,000 meters, it takes you approximately 30 minutes per 1,000. So you'd be talking 2.5 hours to get down to 5,000 meters. And that is quite a long time, but the beauty of it is that we can stay down there so long. When you're using an HOV, you're using up quite a bit of your batteries to get down and to get back up, so it shortens your dive times.
An HOV, sorry, what's an HOV?
Human-occupied vehicles, battery-powered.
Ah, right, okay. Let's talk a little bit about control of an ROV. Since it's remotely operated, there's always an operator, I guess. How do you control such a robot? What are the tasks of an operator? Maybe walk us through a typical mission for an ROV.
Well, how about if I start out with just describing the control vans, the area, the personnel needed, and
yes,
such,
of course.
And maybe go into a... So Jason takes approximately 6 people to operate at a time. So in order to do 24-hour ops, you'd need 18 people. 3 people up front in the control vans. The control vans are 2 shipping containers that have been that have false walls. We bolt them together and we plug them in together, and they basically turn into a approximately 5 by 7 meter workspace. We have on the order of 70 computer monitors in there, including about 15 medium screen monitors. I think they're 24-inch monitors, and those are right in front of the pilot. I would guess that there was somewhere in the order of 50 or 60 computers in there. There's also accessible only by the outside, the jetway, which actually powers up the ROV. The ROV is a power hog. It demands high voltage because we're putting it down such a long piece of cable. The piece of cable is up to 11 kilometers long. So what we do is we pump, I believe it's 2,800 volts at about 100 amps down the cable. So the control vans have three people up front. We have an engineer on one side of the pilot, and we have a navigator on the other side of the pilot being in the middle. And in between the pilot and the navigator is the watch leader, or the lead scientist. Now, the pilot is driving the vehicle, and he is responsible for the safety of it and all that. And his engineer, is monitoring a lot of the systems on the vehicle and also controlling the depth of Medea, or the altitude of Medea over Jason. The navigator on my other side is actually controlling the ship's movement via DP system, which is the dynamic positioning system of the ship. It uses thrusters to stay in the same position and can usually hold, in reasonable weather, I think it's a 5-meter watch circle. So the ship just doesn't move. It uses a GPS signal and the ship's thrusters to stay in one position. Now, when the navigator wants to move the ship, what he does is he moves the reference for the GPS. He doesn't really drive the ship. He can't change the heading. He can only control the direction the ship's going to move in. Now, in between myself, the pilot, and the navigator is the watch leader. The watch leader directs the dive, or his portion of the dive, and also interprets the real-time data. We're recording three video channels, the science pan and tilt, the pilot's pan and tilt, and the basket cam, another one that looks down at the work area. Operating the vehicle is a lot of fun. You're basically in a very, very comfortable seat with the joyback sitting in your lap. And driving the vehicle takes a little bit of practice, but it's amazingly easy. Nothing happens fast as you're underwater, and the vehicle is only capable of going a knot. A typical science mission would be to go and sample one area, which would probably start off by doing some photo mosaicing of the area before you started to work on it. And by that, what we do is we actually envision a grid and put it down on our nav program, and then drive the grid at a certain speed, snapping photos of the area at a certain rate, which can later be put into a photo mosaic that will show us the whole area. They'll actually stitch the photos together. There's lots of software for it these days that just line up your photos, and it takes common patterns and puts them together. So once we'd be done photo mosaicing, we'd probably go in and start sampling. We use in our own suite of samplers, we have push cores, which actually do sediment samples. We have the biology sampler called the SLURP system. We have quite a few instruments like that. But mostly science brings their own instruments, whether it be fluid samplers, gas tight samplers. A lot of times they'll want to get a sample, and instead of sampling it at ambient pressures on the surface of the ocean on the surface ship, they put it in a pressure vessel so that they can actually do some sampling while the thing is still held at the pressures that it lived at, because so much of it will change while it's coming up in the submarine, and actually, you know, the lack of pressure will usually kill most biological samples. So we put things in pressure vessels these days, and there was a very interesting sampler on the vehicle from Harvard last year that was actually a blender that you'd actually inject RNA into the sample and then blend it so that it would preserve the sample it would die at its own pressure where it lived, and then they could sample it and get much more accurate information from it. Some of the more interesting samplers we've used are something called the Beast, which is developed, at UW. And that is a fluid sampler that you would basically stick your wand into either a hot vent or an area you knew fluids to be coming out of, and they take a series of small samples. We spend a lot of time working around the hot vents, whether it be Juan de Fuca, Lau Basin, East Pacific Rise. That seems to be the larger part of the interest of the science community these days, so we do spend a lot of time working around these hot vents. And these hot vents are just amazing you know, tube worms and shrimp, and it's just funny to find things living at 3,000 meters. The heat and the nutrients coming out of the hot vents are what are actually, you know, keeping these things alive. But what I always wonder about is how they got there in the first place. But I believe that is, I just walked you through a reasonable Jason dive as far as the sampling and the setup and all that.
Let's talk about more specific dive. Recently, you managed to see an underwater volcano erupt. Can you tell us about that dive and what were your impressions and reactions of everybody?
I can. And I think it was May of last year, we departed Samoa to go to a site that science had discovered. I believe they had used a CTD and had discovered a plume in the water. So they suspected that an active volcano was erupting underwater. We went back approximately 5 months later with the ROV Jason and dove on it. And amazingly enough, we had some accurate information on where it would be located within a few hundred meters. We put the vehicle in, and less than 24 hours after leaving Samoa, we were actually looking at this volcano. This volcano was one of the most spectacular sights I've ever seen, seeing actually flames underwater. I believe it was at 500 meters of depth. Driving a $5 million vehicle up to a volcano is a bit unnerving. Being in charge of the system, I'm always losing a little bit of sleep, wondering if we're going to have an event and the vehicle is just going to disappear in it. But that didn't seem to be the case on this last cruise. Although we watched molten lava erupting. We have video of that. We took some samples of the lava as it was coming out of the volcano. We actually took a piece of titanium and just stuck it in there and tried to get it to stick. We actually had to use the continuous rotate feature to get it to stick on there, kind of like you would be winding taffy. So this volcano just happened to be going off. It was crazy. I'd never seen anything like it. It was one of the most exciting times I've had in the control vans. The science party was just out of control. They were just so happy with what had happened. They'd never actually seen this kind of footage on the bottom of the ocean, and to just, you know, find it that quickly and easily was just amazing. We had a couple events which were pretty the vehicle did the volcano did flash once while we were sampling it, and it almost covered the vehicle in volcanic ash and dust and made the vehicle too heavy. As you can imagine, we try to keep the vehicle a little bit light in the ocean so that you're not thrusting down to keep it down there, because you would be disturbing the sediment in the bottom of the ocean, so you have to try to keep it a little bit light. When this event occurred, we actually had rocks and dust and ash all covering the vehicle. We actually had to use our slurp system to vacuum the vehicle off to make it light enough to float again. Once again, working around active volcanoes can be dangerous, but that's why we send ROVs there and not HOVs.
Did you see any interesting wildlife down there, or marine life, I guess I should say?
I don't think we saw much wildlife right on the volcano itself, but there was some erupting vents close by that we did see some shrimp and some interesting biology.
Great. You mentioned earlier that you were also involved in the dive to see the Titanic. Can you tell us anything about that?
Well, that was my first cruise. I had just gotten out of the Navy and came to work for Woods Hole Oceanographic as a mess attendant. It was basically acting like a waiter/dishwasher on the ship. And it was my first cruise, and it was the laboratory that I work with that was out there using Argo and Angus to search for the Titanic. Approximately, I think it was 5 days after we got on station, we were using Argo, which just had sit cams on it, and they saw an image of a debris field and then came over the boiler of the Titanic. And immediately recovered everything as we had a position and laid down a transponder net and then put the vehicle back in and started looking around. And the wreck was found somewhat shortly after that. It was just an amazing cruise. I had no clue we were even going to look for it before I got out there. Back in those days, we were using, once again, Argo and Angus, and the technology was a little different than we're doing now. We didn't have fiber optics. We basically just had coax, and it would take almost 4 minutes for an image to come up the cable. So you'd snap a picture, you'd have to wait 4 minutes to actually see what the picture was. So you'd actually be past that area if you were moving. Argo, I believe, also had a side scan on it, and four sit cams looking in all directions. But a little bit after that, we went back to explore the wreck of the Titanic with Alvin and Jason Jr. And that was the first iteration of Jason at Woods Hole, and that was developed to use fiber optic technology back then.
I see. So I guess things have really progressed and moved forward since then, especially, I guess, in technology of sensors.
Yes, they have, amazingly so.
What do you think is left to do? What is the next frontier for ROVs and very deep sea diving robots that we expect to see in the next few years?
I believe that we are working towards using a remote operated vehicle without a cable. That is the next frontier, and whether that be acoustic modems or what, but that is basically turning an AUV into an ROV is, I think, our next big hurdle.
What advantage would that give us not to be tethered?
Well, advantages and disadvantages. All of a sudden, you'd have to use battery power. That creates its own problem. Some of the advantages are that you wouldn't have to stay so close to Medea. Our biggest challenge these days, or not biggest challenge, but one of our things that keep us from making a lot of, or costs us some time, is the ship can only move at about a knot. And we have to wait. If we're working at 5,000 meters, it takes almost 30 minutes for Medea to start to move because there's 5 kilometers of cable between the ship and Medea. So the ship will start to move, and Medea will start to move 20, 30 minutes later. And the ship stops, Medea stops 20 or 30 minutes later. So if you could operate autonomously from Medea, basically just having your link via Medea and not a cable to it, it would just speed things up dramatically. And it would also change the way we launch and recover things. But I believe that is our next big hurdle.
Before we go, can you tell us of any upcoming missions that we should keep an eye on and look at the news for?
We'll be going back to the volcanoes, both Rota and Mata. We'll be going to Rota this year in March. That should be exciting. And I believe the following year we'll be going back to this volcano that we're talking about, Mata. Those would be some of the biggest things we do. But we've also got some cruises coming up on, I think, off of Hawaii, where we're going to be plugging in some cabled observatories. That's about it planned for this year.
Great. Well, we look forward to seeing some more interesting images from you guys. And all the best in your research. Thank you very much for being on Robots.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
For a chance to win the 2 robot kits offered by Diddle SA, we asked you who made the giant 6-legged robot. Turns out there were actually 2 answers to this question, any of which qualified our many participants for the lottery. The first possible answer was Julie Townsend from the NASA, and her athlete robot, which was featured in one of our recent episodes. The second giant-legged robot was actually called the Giant 6-legged robot by its creator, Jamie Mansell, who was featured in April of last year.
And I have a bag of names here, so why don't you pick one out?
Okay, I have one here. The winner of the 2 robot kits is Will Preston. Congratulations, we'll be sending you your kit shortly.
Don't worry, there will still be lots of competitions in the future. Until then, make sure you have a look at our website for the latest discussions and hot topics in robotics at www.robotspodcast.com.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Go Deep with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.